truly thankful for each one's presence. We gather here again in the great name of Jesus Christ, which is the sweetest and greatest name on mortal tongue. We come to study a diminutive portion of His Word, and it is pretty small at that, the portion that we'll get to study. Those of you who were not with us last night, we introduced the congregation here to a very brief and condensed study of the first vision of the book of Revelations. And we made it through about three chapters and just kind of laid the groundwork for how we would propose to you that this book should be studied. I guess it was nearly 20 years ago in Clyde, Texas. I'm sure Glenda would remember this when we studied the book there all the way through. One of the old fellows there, who's of course now long dead and gone, John D. Halliburton, he was out of duty, but he came because he wanted to hear the book of Revelations. And he kept saying, you know, this is getting interesting. He said, I want to see how all this turns out. And after he said that about the third time, I said, John, it ain't going to matter if you don't come back to church. And that's really the main thing that matters, is that we get our life right. It is better to understand and to know what's going on. And really, it's almost impossible to know the Bible and not know what's going on. The Bible is a very informative book. It knows humanity real well. It's written by the very God who fearfully and wonderfully made us. And this is why this God is able to look down the stream of time and to show us events precisely as they will occur. You know, the Old Testament is about 65 to 70% prophecy. So if you study it at all, you've got to study prophecy. And that's what the book of Revelations will be tonight, the part that we will study. And if you were to ask me, what Old Testament commentary would you recommend for me to study these prophecies, I'd tell you whichever one's the cheapest, whichever one is available to you, whichever one you see on the shelf, whichever one you can read the easiest, just get it, because it don't hardly matter. Almost everybody agrees on Old Testament prophecy. And one reason is, it doesn't matter anymore. It's already happened, and it applied to the Jews. And since it's not my or your obligation, we don't disagree on that. We disagree on how to be saved, and how to get to heaven, and how to worship, and we disagree on our prophecies of today, because they are pertaining to us. But it seems like everybody, regardless of their past backgrounds or religious learning, can go to the Old Testament and read the Old Testament prophecies, which, as I mentioned last night, are oftentimes worded almost exactly like they are in the book of Revelations. But they can read them and understand them. And when they get to the Revelation letter, we diverse and go to quite a few different directions as to what they might be. But some of the deepest, I mean the deepest of Old Testament prophecies, you will find that basically nearly all Bible scholars agree on the gist of what took place. So tonight when we get into this, we're going to be talking about the first set of serious symbols that comes out, and they're going to be horses. Before John introduced those four horses to us, he gave us a most vivid scene upon his apostolic vision. He gave us a scene of heaven and of all the creatures round about it. And this is found in chapter 4 and chapter 5. I'm not going to read those two chapters, but I'll just give you a quick, hurried overview of them. What John saw there was pretty much everything that goes on with God. He saw the throne where God sat. He saw Jesus with Him. He saw the four beasts that were around that throne. And that's probably a poor rendering right there, because actually it means living creatures. He saw four living creatures, and those four living creatures that he saw parallel with the same four creatures that Isaiah saw and that Ezekiel saw. And if you'll read Ezekiel's account in Ezekiel chapter 6, and if you'll read, Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 6, and if you'll read Ezekiel in chapter 1 through about chapter 10, you will find that they describe these four creatures with practically the same description as John did. These four creatures were angelic in nature. Apparently they were God's four top creatures. And they seem to have some characteristics and traits that are so admirable. I mean, they just make you back off and wonder about how great God really can be. They had eyes within and without. They could see everywhere. They traveled only forward. I'm putting all three together here to come up with this now. They could travel only forward. Now imagine a creature that never had reverse but never lost itself. Just kept traveling forward and knew right where he was. They had wings. Angels do have wings. Isaiah said they had six of them. With two they cover their head, with two they cover their feet, with two they fly. They had men's hands protruding from their wings. And they had little feet coming out from those wings that looked like the bottom of calves' feet. They shone like burnished brass. They had a circle above their head that we call halo, and that circle that Ezekiel called a wheel shone like the color of a terrible crystal. And these creatures moved up and down throughout the earth and throughout all the spaces that God has given them to roam in, and they were called seraphims by Isaiah and cherubims by Ezekiel. And a cherubim is a creature that serves and works and takes care of God's business. And a seraphim is one who serenades and one who sings. And that's the two things, evidently, that angels do, is they just serve God, work, and do what He wants them to do, and they sing praises to God. Now, that's what John saw in Revelations 4 and 5. He saw these four creatures, the 24 elders, all come up around the throne, and he witnessed one of the greatest praise services that ever took place behind the curtains of old glory. I mean, he saw them come up and praise this God that lived forever and ever. And one of the reasons that they burst forth with such praise to him is because of the little book that they saw in the hand of God that Jesus was able to open. Thank God tonight that he was able to open it, because that little book was the Revelation letter. God held in his hand a little book. And John said, I heard the voice of a strong angel proclaiming throughout the world and the earth, who is worthy to open the book and to reveal the contents therein? So that question was asked everywhere. Who can do this? And it says that they searched heaven, earth, and beneath the earth. So they searched the angelic realm, the earthly realm where humans are, beneath the earth in the demon world where demons are, and there was nobody with the moral worthiness to open this little book that God had in his hand that was sealed with seven seals. This caused old John, the tender-hearted apostle, to get somewhat emotional. He broke down and wept because, you see, he'd been wafted away in the Spirit. He had been brought up here before God. He had been told to write the things that you see and put them in a book and send them to the seven churches which are in Asia. So he's ready to go, and about that time he's told, sorry, the whole mission has been thwarted. The book is shut. Nobody can open it. We don't know what it's going to say. And he says, I broke down and I cried. And about the time he started crying, one of those beasts spoke to him and said, weep not, John, for the Lion of the tribe of Judah hath prevailed to open the book. That was Jesus Christ. He came from that tribe. And he's a mighty lion, you see. And he saw this lamb as though it had been slain go up there and take that book out of the hand of God and open it up. And forthwith came the prophecy that we will study tonight. The information that God wanted us as His servants to know. And we concluded last night by just using the common horse sense that God has given us, that if the book of Revelations is prophecy, it has to be predictions of things that would come to pass. It has to happen after John received it, not before, or that would be past history. We concluded that since it says of itself, this is things that will be hereafter, are things that will shortly come to pass, that we had to start with the time that John received the revelation and look down through time and hopefully see if we can find things that seem to fit these signs and symbols. Otherwise, we'll be like a ship out here tossed on a sea, not knowing whither we go. So we will take you now to the sixth chapter of Revelation. And here the four horses ride out in rapid succession. Let us read about all four of them to kind of set the stage, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about them. Let's just start at verse 2. And I saw, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow. And a crown was given unto him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. And when he had opened the second seal, I heard the second beast say, come and see. And there went out another horse that was red, and power was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another, and there was given unto him a great sword. And when he had opened the third seal, I heard the third beast say, come and see. And I beheld, and lo, a black horse, and he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say, a measure of wheat for a penny, three measures of barley for a penny, and see that thou hurt not the oil and the wine. And when he had opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth beast say, come and see. And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and his name that sat on him was Death and Hell, followed with him. And power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth to kill with sword, and with hunger, and with death, and with the beast of the earth. Now then, this is where the prophecy starts, right here. From here on out, that's all it will be till you get to the last chapter. This is like a treasure map. This is like directions to find somebody's home. You go down here, take a left, take a right, take a left, take a right. But what if you go down here and take a right instead of a left? You just do one thing wrong, but then follow it the rest of the way, well, you're going to wind up way over here in Sheol or somewhere. So we've got to start off right. If we start off wrong, then the further we go, the worse off we're going to be. Right? But if we pinpoint these horses to mean what they ought to mean, then the further we go in Revelations, the clearer it will get, and the better it will fit. This is why so many commentaries get so way out in left field. They start wrong, and they end up wrong. Now then, there's two prophecies in the Old Testament that are very similar to this right here. There's one in Zechariah about four horses pulling chariots. Now, I won't go over there and read it. I'm doing everything in my power to save time and not be so meticulous, because I know if I go there, I'll get carried away. But these four horses rode out in Zechariah's vision, all four colored differently. And again, most Old Testament expositors agree that they represented four different kingdoms. There is no question that the things that Daniel saw was that way. And I want to go to the book of Daniel first before I get into these four horses. Let's go to Daniel, the second chapter, because it will involve not only prophecy, but also the future of the church and so forth. Let's go to Daniel chapter 2. And here we're introduced to that vision that Nebuchadnezzar had that troubled him so much that he called in Daniel to help him understand this great vision. Daniel did, because he had the Spirit of God within him. And Daniel informed him that that beast, or that creature he saw standing there, like a big huge statue, that was made of gold, and then made of silver, and then brass, and then iron and clay. He informed him that that represented four different kingdoms. Daniel himself said that. I'm not making that up. He said that. In fact, the last part of verse 38, Daniel said, "Thou art this head of gold." So in this vision that Nebuchadnezzar had, he was represented by the head of gold. He says, "After thee," verse 39, "shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth, and the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things," and so forth. He describes in that fourth kingdom how that since it was iron mixed with clay, that meant that it would be a divided and diverse kingdom that would eventually fall because of all the cultural mixtures within it. But he then said something about that fourth kingdom that's very interesting. He said in verse 44, "In the days of these kings," speaking of the fourth one, "in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all their kingdoms, and it shall stand forever." Daniel saw that in the days of the fourth kingdom, which is the Roman Empire, that God would set a kingdom up during that Roman Empire. And his kingdom would outlast the Roman Empire. It would outlast the Ottoman Empire. It would outlast the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Hungarian Empire. It would outlast the Grecian Empire. And it would stand and last forever. And I hope, of course, that you understand what that kingdom was. It was a kingdom that he said was not of this world. And that's that spiritual kingdom, the Church of Jesus Christ, that was set up. And it was definitely established in the days of the Roman Empire, when it was almost at its zenith. That's when it was established. All right. In the book of Daniel as well, chapter 7, Belshazzar also had a vision that paralleled the same thing. But it was mentioned in that vision that the four things he saw was four creatures. And they represented the same things that Nebuchadnezzar saw in the statue. But he saw four beasts. And the first beast he saw, chapter 7, verse 4, was a lion that had eagle's wings. The second beast that he saw was a bear. And the third one that he saw was a leopard. And then the fourth one was just a terrible, dreadful beast. Didn't really identify it. Just a terrible and dreadful beast, exceedingly strong. He was diverse from all the beasts before it. This is in verse 7. And he says, and it had 10 horns. Well, the beast of Revelation that is described also had 10 horns as well. And so they parallel here, you see. He said in verse 8, I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. Now, this is the one that really bothered Daniel. Because Daniel is seeing down through here that somewhere in all of this, God's going to do something that's really important. I mean, Daniel loved the people of God. So anything that had to do with God's progress on earth, he was concerned about it. And he saw this kingdom that would be established in a fourth kingdom down the line, that would be the people of God in that kingdom, and that particular kingdom, in that fourth kingdom, he said, he saw that fourth kingdom persecuting God's people. And they were terrible against it. And when he saw how many thousands were killed by that fourth kingdom, he says, my cogitations were troubled. And he was not able to sleep because he didn't want to even visualize such a thing. It was something he didn't even want to think about, was all of God's people being destroyed and killed by this fourth kingdom. But it was the same kingdom that God established his church within. And do you know that's why the Roman Empire couldn't stand the church? They couldn't stand the church because it never fully submitted to them. Because it was another kingdom. It was a kingdom within their kingdom. And they called them superstitious people. That's what they called the Christians. Because they served this guy who had died. I mean, they didn't even have a king to point to. They had one on the throne. His name was Caesar. And look to him, you know. I mean, they were a great and mighty nation. And here was all these people out here who were turning the world upside down, who really wouldn't pay allegiance to Caesar, who would even die before they would, and they served another king. And he was dead. I mean, they had played the part in killing him. And they just could not figure out these weird, superstitious people called Christians. And after a while, it got under their skin so much that they launched massive persecutions against the church. Thousands upon millions of Christians were killed by the Roman Empire alone. Their favorite sport was the gladiator arenas. And they loved to bring in the Christians. And they'd give them a little stick, or they'd give them a fishing net. And then they'd turn in a pack of hungry lions to eat these Christians. And these old emperors would set up there, you know, under a big old palm leaf being fanned above their head. They'd eat fresh grapes out of the vineyard, and they'd laugh as each Christian got torn to shreds. That was their favorite sport. I mean, they loved it. They pulled no bones about it, you know. And the annals of history perfectly record this and tell us that this was the case. Well, folks, let's face it then. Since John was marooned to the Isle of Patmos in AD 96, since he receives a revelation of things that are shortly to begin to happen, since the church is God's primary focal point of concern, and the world is what the church has to deal with, then whatever world was involved at that time would probably be involved in any prophecy that started in this great book. Okay? We read, first of all, about a white horse, did we not? Let's read that again just to set the scene. Let's read verse 2 again. I saw and beheld a white horse. He that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given unto him. He went forth conquering and to conquer. Now that's all we got to go on, right there. Now, in the last 50 years or so, commentators have really upscaled themselves. We've moved into a new dimension in religion today. And they're starting to generalize the book of Revelations, which has to be a tool of the devil, because the devil doesn't really want you to know what's going on. And if you go to your average Baker or Zondervan bookstore and buy a commentary on this book, almost every one of them will tell you that this white horse represents Jesus Christ. Don't sound too bad either. They give some good reasoning. White, purity, represents prosperity and purity and so forth. This white horse went forth conquering and to conquer, and we sometimes sing the song, how that His truth is marching on, and Jesus is definitely a great conqueror. His kingdom's going to conquer all other kingdoms. And, you know, they can capitalize on those particular points right there, and they can make you or get you to believing that quite possibly it does represent Jesus Christ. Well, I'll tell you what I know for sure. I know that Jesus does ride on a white horse. And I know that based on what I read in Revelation chapter 19. So let's go to Revelation 19 now, and let's put Scripture with Scripture. Let's compare the white horse that we know is the rider, that the rider is Jesus, and let's see if we see similarities or differences here. That will make a difference, believe you me. All right? Verse 11 of Revelation 19. I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse. He that sat on him was called Faithful and True. In righteousness he doth judge and make war. Oh, it's pretty obvious we're talking about Jesus. It's in heaven. He's righteous in His judgment. His name is Faithful and True. This is Jesus. His eyes were as a flame of fire. We confirmed that last night. On His head were many crowns. And He had a name written that no man knew but He Himself. He was clothed with a vesture dipped in blood. And His name is called the Word of God. Wasn't the Word made flesh and dwelt among us? Well, this is Jesus, all right? And the armies which were in heaven followed Him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and clean. And out of His mouth goeth a sharp sword, that with it He should smite the nations, and He shall rule them with a rod of iron. He treadeth the winepress of the fierceness of the wrath of Almighty God. He hath on His vesture and on His thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Now, then nobody can argue with that. Revelation 19 is Jesus, King of Kings, Lord of Lords, vesture dipped in blood. He has many crowns. He's the King of every kingdom. He's the King of every nation. He has all power and all authority. All right, now let's compare that. Let's compare that. Revelation 6, Revelation 19, two white horses. Let's see what we got here. White does compare. And beyond that, that's about it. This man over here has a crown on his head. And that word crown comes from a Greek word. It means a soldier's caplet or a soldier's cap. The word over here says he has many crowns. One crown is on this man's head. Many crowns are on this man's head. And this Greek word here means a diadem worn by a royal one. All right? There's a difference there. This man over here, he went forth conquering and to conquer. All right, now let's be grammatically correct here. A.D. 96, sometime thereafter, John gets a prophecy. Whoever is on this white horse went forth. Jesus had already done that, folks. Jesus died in A.D. 34, and that's when, as we say, He conquered death, hell, and the grave, and He started conquering right then and there, and He'd already been doing this for some 60 years. He was already a conqueror. But this man goes forth and starts conquering and to conquer. This man right here rides upon a white horse, and look at his weapon. It's a weapon that is in his hand. A bow is in his hand. He's fighting with his hands. A bow, a weapon of warfare. This one over here, he has a sword, and that sword that he fights with is a sword that proceeds out of his mouth. That's what the Lord fights with, the Word of God, the sword of the Spirit. Can you see that there's really not a comparison here at all? You know what? I could come nearer proving to you that this white horse is the devil than I could prove to you that it was Jesus Christ. While the devil dresses as a wolf in sheep's clothing, that's pretty white, isn't it? He goes forth conquering and to conquer. In fact, it looks to me like he's winning this battle. The whole world seems to be his. Yeah. And he's got a crown. He's the God of this world. The next horse is the red horse. That would come near being Jesus. Red, dipped in blood. And it says of the red horse, to him was given a great sword. Only one, a great sword. That would come near being Jesus, if you want to get that away. All right? Now let me point out something to you. Those who go to Revelations and interpret this white horse here as being Jesus Christ have thereby interpreted it as a spiritual horse. Jesus. Immediately then, they go to the red, black, and pale horse and interpret them as being carnal horses. Wonder why they switch. Who gave thee that authority? It seems to me like they're all spiritual or they're all carnal. Why would you switch? Who told you to? It's just a vision of things that would occur upon this earth. So then, if we've got a white horse here that has a weapon in his hand that he's conquering with, he goes forth and he has a crown and so forth, and it does not parallel with Jesus, as it seems to me that it doesn't. Evidently then, somewhere after the time of John, something must have happened on earth with somebody or with a combination of people that this symbol here can apply to. So let me introduce you here to what I think might be something you could consider. There was a man by the name of Nerva who was the emperor of Rome. He had no children, so he adopted a man by the name of Trajan, a son who was a Cretan from the Isle of Crete. That son then assumed his throne and he began to rule. Trajan was the greatest Roman general of all time. Britannica backs this up. He's the one that they all admired because you know why? He never lost a battle. He rode a white horse, literally. And every time he conquered, he would ride back to Rome on this white horse and he would be honored by the Roman Senate. He was a Cretan, and you know that the Romans are known for their swords. The Roman sword. I mean, you know that if you know anything about history at all. Cretans were not known for their swords. They were known for their bow and arrow ability. Trajan won the Grecian Olympics 7 years in a row. The Parthians were also known as bow and arrow men, and the Parthians would watch Trajan. In fact, I read this one time, I think, from Tacitus in some of his historical writings, and it talked about these Parthians here gathered at the Grecian Olympic site, and they were watching Trajan, and he was practicing, and he took some strings and stretched them up real tight, backed off so many paces, and went back and shot those strings and busted each and every string. And they just kind of walked away in disbelief, knowing that they had to compete with him on the morrow in the bow and arrow competition. That man right there inherited the throne in 98 A.D. And he went out and began to conquer. He never lost a battle. He rode a white horse. He was a master with the bow and arrow. And he doubled, yea, nearly tripled the size of the Roman Empire that the church had been established in. He did that. Not only that, after he left his throne, two other individuals after him still enjoyed this great prosperity. And I think what I will do for you here, I've got a little book here that's got some condensed pieces of history in it. And I'm going to read you just a small portion of history, because I know history is almost as boring as a lecture on how to bake beans. But if you like history, it's not that way to you. But listen, I've condensed this. I'm going to read just the meat of the matter, okay? Won't take very long. Here's a historian recording from about AD 98 to about 135. Here's what he says. The success of Trajan, however transient, was rapid and spacious. The degenerate Parthians, broken by intestinal discord, fled before his arms. He descended the river Tigris in triumph from the mountains of Armenia to the Persian Gulf. He enjoyed the honor of being the first, and he was the last of the Roman generals who ever navigated that remote sea. His fleets ravaged the coast of Arabia, and Trajan vainly flattered himself that he was approaching the confines of India. Every day the astonished Senate received the intelligence of new names and new nations that acknowledged his sway. They were informed that the kings of Bosporus, Colchis, Iberia, Albania, Acheron, and even the Parthian monarch himself had accepted their diadems from the hands of the emperor, that the independent tribes of the Medians and Carduchian hills had implored his protection, and that the rich countries of Armenia, Mesopotamia, and Assyria were reduced into the state of provinces. This is a historian who probably didn't believe a whip in Jesus Christ, just recording the facts of history at this time, saying that here is an era of time in Roman history that is unparalleled and unmatched. And here's a general here who just went out. Notice all those countries he mentions that were just subdued the provinces as he went forth conquering and to conquer each and every country. Now, that's so brief, and I really would like to say more, but suffice it to say this, if I'm wrong, it'll get worse as we go. If we're right, and let me back up, and I don't want to use the word I. If this is wrong, okay? Alexander Campbell believed this. Barton Stone believed this. Fred Kerbel believed this. I got his sermons on tape. Fred Kerbel, Barney Welsh believed this. That don't make it right. But folks, there were people who lived long before me who were smarter than me. And I take stock in some of the old fathers. I don't mind telling you I believe what somebody believed 100 years ago. I don't mind admitting to you that a lot of my thoughts that I have did not come from me. I don't want to be a plagiarist. I don't mind admitting that I went back and dug into old books. I mentioned last night some of the commentaries, Stewart, Eliot, various ones and so forth that I've read from. I don't mind telling you that when I read what they had to say, I thought, hey, that's the best yet. I read what others said, and I gave them a fair shake. And I thought, well, that don't work. That don't harmonize with Scripture. That don't harmonize with history. That doesn't work out the further you go. I found that the belief that Revelations is a historical book that gives both history of the world and history of the church, and believe me, it won't just be stuff like this as we proceed through. The church will be involved as well, and it will mention the church quite a bit. And the fact that this occurred had a lot to do with the church, because they covered the entire civilized world at that time and ruled the whole world. And because they opposed the church so strongly, it's only natural. As one commentator states, it may be Albert Barnes, I don't remember, but one of them states, the history of the persecuted will naturally include the history of the persecutors. That makes sense. Certainly. If you're getting persecuted, who did the persecuting? A judge would ask that in court. Okay, if we're wrong, it'll get worse as we go. If not, it'll seem to start fitting even better and better as we go. All right, the next horse was a red one, right? What about that red horse? Power was given to him that set thereon to take peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another. And there was given unto him a great sword. Now that's civil war. He took peace from the earth, and they began to kill one another. Okay? After Trajan and his next two successors, let me tell you what happened in the Roman Empire. A man named Commodus, which was the great grandson of Nerva, took over. And Commodus was a blooming idiot. He was a lunatic. I mean, the guy had voodoo ideas. He'd wear fireproof suits and set himself on fire up on the stage before the people. I mean, he'd strip naked out in front of them. Even the Romans would run away from him. The guy was goofy. And they put up with him for about 10 years. And they decided, you know, we need somebody up there that knows his left hand from his right. And rebellious tones was all over Rome. All right, there was this thing called the Praetorian Prefect, which was the Senate. The Senate had 100 members. Those 100 men that ruled in the Senate were not nearly as strong as our senators and our congressmen are. If the emperor said, in essence, I don't want to mess with that, y'all take care of that, then they had all kinds of power. When he designated the power to them and said, y'all do this or y'all handle that matter, they could do anything. They could take people's lives. But they could not overrule the emperor. And if a matter came up and it had come to them first, they would never finalize it until they talked with the emperor, because he had the final say. He was the dictator. The Praetorian Prefect had one man who was head over it. And where he sat, there was a sword beside him 6 foot high. He was given that sword as a symbol of his position. They met together secretly and decided to kill Commodus. And so they just devised a little plan, and some of the senators got over here on one side of Commodus, and they began to act just about as crazy as he did, and he got all carried away in what they were doing, and while he was sitting here watching, this man who was Pertinax, who was the head of the Praetorian Prefect, he took that great sword and just stabbed him through with it and killed him. And then he ascended to the throne. There's where the inner warfare started. He stabbed the emperor. He proclaimed himself as the ruler. And it wasn't but about 80 days that he ruled, and he got killed, and another crazy fellow took over. And when this began to happen, just one after another killing each other, the Roman armies, which were stationed all over the world, rebelled against their sawdust emperors. Up there above the Danube River was a man named Didius Julianus. And when he got the news of all of this crazy monkey business going on down there in Rome, he took the largest army that Rome had right there, and he asked them about the situation, and they all voted in favor that he become their emperor. They crowned him as the emperor. He then left his territory, came down to Rome, and he conquered those who were ruling at that time. Severus was then the ruler when he came down. He conquered and killed him. At the same time, news was slow back then, you see. They didn't even have the Pony Express, hardly. News is a little slower than it is nowadays. At the same time, the army in Britain, the army in North Africa, and the army in Saudi Arabia had done the same thing. And little, without one knowing about the other, all of them were marching to Rome at the same time. All of them were leaving their territories unguarded, and they gathered together, and they fought and depleted some 70% of their own armies. They killed one another. That's what they done. And you know what? When civil war breaks out, the renegades pop up. The terrorists come out of the woodwork. Everybody goes crazy. It's kind of like a chicken that's been in a coop. I don't know if you've ever dealt with chickens, but chickens are funny animals. They can get so excited over the littlest of nothing and make the biggest to-do about it that you ever saw. And if you've got an old chicken in a coop, and she's been in there for years and years, and you open that door, she don't just fly out. She kind of perks up. And she looks around, and she walks up to the edge of that deal, and she'll stick her neck way out like this, and she'll go. You know, she'll look over here, and she'll look over there, and she'll squat down. You think she's going to fly. And she'll stop, and she'll look, and she'll go, pop, 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 pop. You know, she looks, and she looks, and after a while, when you think she's never going to do nothing, she just goes fluttering out of there, and just, whoo, here she goes, and just throws a big fit, you know, because she's all of a sudden realized, I'm free. I'm free at last, you know. I mean, it just finally dawned on her, the door is no longer shut. Well, it took a little while, but it didn't take long. When all these armies left all these countries, and they were left unguarded, in nearly every spot, somebody would pop up and say, hey, guess what? They're gone. They're gone. Hey, I'm the king of the mountain. And he'd form an army. And then they'd go to fighting. And every nation began to fight once amongst the other for supremacy. And here was little miniature Caesars popping up everywhere because there was nobody there to subdue them. Say what you want to about Iraq. I think they were just about as well off with Saddam as with anybody because all they're going to do is fight like game roosters anyway. You kind of have to control people like that. Some people just ain't going to let sleeping dogs lie. They're just going to fight. And so here we had incessant warfare all over the earth for a long, long time, to the point, folks, that there was hardly anyone left to even plow the fields. I mean, it got pretty serious across the country. And let me read you a very small portion of history on that one. And this is from Sismondi, his book, about the fall of the Roman Empire. You may have Gibbons. I don't know. I do. Now I got Tacitus and Sismondi. And I know you're not a history buff like Meter Jordan was. You know, Jordan Foreman, you know, he's a history buff. But let me read this little small portion to you that Sismondi had to say. With Commodus commenced the third and most calamitous period. It lasted 92 years from 192 to 284. During that period, 32 emperors and 27 pretenders alternately hurled each other from the throne by incessant warfare. That's what history says about the period of time from 192 to 284. I mean, nearly 100 emperors wound up killing each other, and of course I could have read more about all the armies and everybody that just committed total chaotic civil warfare all over the world. What did it say? They took peace from the earth. They killed one another, and to them was given a great sword. You may not like what I'm saying here, but you'll have to admit so far it fits. Okay? So far it fits. All right, now let's go to the next one, the black horse. I beheld, and lo, a black horse, and he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And the voice said in the midst of the four beasts, a measure of wheat for a penny, three measures of barley for a penny, and see that thou hurt not the oil or the wine. It would only make common sense, really, that if there was a lot of warfare, and if people were ravaged by these wars, and you know wars are horrible. Back then, fire was their greatest asset. I mean, everywhere they'd go, they'd just set fire to everything that they went to. They sowed salt in the fields. I mean, they'd done all kinds of things. They damaged and ravaged the land. They destroyed crops. They killed lives. They took innocent people. You know how war is. And if you had warfare for some 90 solid years, everywhere in every nation under heaven, you can imagine it gets pretty black. It would get pretty bleak. It would get to the point, you know, that it would be maybe hard to even find a bushel of wheat or a measure of barley. Balances. What does balances represent? What's that a symbol of? That's a symbol of trying to weigh this thing out. Can we even make it? You do that in business, you know, you say, hey, man, I made $100, but it took 110 to make it. Wait a minute, the balances are kind of going this way. If you can't at least get that thing to even out, I mean, you got to at least break even, folks. That's why you try to balance these things out. And you want it to tip in favor of your income instead of your outgo. So they're taking these balances here and they're saying, man, food, clothing, shelter, you know, the vital necessities of life. Where can we have these things? Famine breaks out and all those things. And so now, so that I can hurry on and not take too much time, let me read a little bit of history again. We're only going to do this one more time, and then we're going to move on a little quicker, okay?